Okay. Oh, well, they changed the thing and it records differently. So,
booking devices on.
Welcome everyone to the, I was about to read off the time. That's not right. I want to read off the date. The February 8th Pony Sync. This is the first one I've been at in a while. So I'm very excited. Woo.
Yay.
All right. So shall we get into things? I guess. Yes.
Yes.
Has somebody else been doing this while I've been gone and wants to do it, or otherwise I can do some running of the thing?
1, 2, 3, not it.
Not it.
Well, nobody said they wanted it, so I'll do it this time. I figure it's the least I can do, seeing how it's been like 12 years since I was at one of these.
Yep.
Do we have, no, we only have 2 repos. Do we have anything in the RFCs thing? I don't think we do right now, right? Nope.
The only thing is we could talk about stateful exceptions, but I think Benoit was going to do some experiments and come back to that. So I think that's sort of where we are. Is that right, Benoit?
Yes.
Okay, cool. Okay.
All right, so let's go to the pull requests. This looks like just want to have a tag on it.
I know we can't merge them yet because they're still building, but the top three, 1568, 1566, and 1565, I just want to mention that getting performance improving stuff that include awesome benchmarks is awesome.
Yeah, we got some underlying hash map ones coming as well.
Awesome.
Which make things much better, because those tombstones are deadly, man. And yeah, that was not meant to be a pun. Okay. I'm gonna start with 1507. So this was your one that was an attempt to fix Sylvan, issue 1118, right? And it's sort of hanging out there. It did not fix that or 1483. But the question I had on that is this valuable for correctness even if it doesn't fix those issues? Is this something that we should merge anyway? I mean, it passes the test. Is it good for correctness even if it doesn't fix those?
Theoretically, yes. How's that for an answer?
No, that's a bad I think that's a bad answer. Should we leave this? Should we merge this? These exciting 2 lines that you did here?
I know. Those 2 lines took more thought than you might think. not because they're complicated, because I'm slow. So just to give you a little context here about that, this is Mark Remote Object, where we've run into something immutable that we haven't seen before. That we have seen before. And previously, it was not immutable. So under the circumstances, it was ISO. And if we don't trace it now, theoretically, something could prematurely deallocate it.
How would we get something? How would we have gotten something previously that was ISO? That's a remote. Wait, Mark remote object is that's when I've received, right?
No, it's when you're marking.
Marking. What is a remote object in this case? I want to make sure
something allocated by another actor. So, right. So here's an example. You're passed a foo ISO in a behavior.
Uh-huh.
You receive many foo ISOs in behaviors.
Uh-huh.
But every now and then you take one of them and you assign it to the foo val field in your object.
Uh-huh.
That foo reaches some large object graph.
Uh-huh.
So when you receive it, you do receive remote object and it's isolated. But later when you come back to trace it, you do mark remote object and now all of a sudden it's immutable. It wasn't previously, but we did receive it. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
All right. So at this point, what we need to do is acquire the object, mark it as immutable, acquire it, and make sure that we set on the owning actor the immutable flag so that it knows that it should now take over tracing this thing.
Okay.
Which means that we should continue to trace the current object because, first of all, it's safe to do so. And second of all, we want to make sure that it stays live.
Right. So why would we not want to merge this then?
I think we do want to merge it. That's why I said theoretically yes.
All right. Shall we merge this?
Yeah.
Yeah. And I still want to figure out the one where when you have an ISO and you send it as a val, everything goes to hell. We still have to figure that one out.
Yes. Most definitely.
Which is either a weird-ass memory leak or a weird-ass performance problem. One or the other. I don't know which.
Two things, indeed.
Okay. All right. Merging.
Okay.
Boom. Deleting branch.
All right.
Okay. Merged because this should be good for correctness, even if it didn't fix the issues. Okay. All right. And yes. Okay. Next up, we have, for folks playing along at home, we have a quick discussion around 1524. That's the equatable for IP address or net address.
Oh yeah.
So yeah, I can see how that would be tricky with the SOC addresses and everything that we were discussing earlier, Sylvan.
Yeah.
So. I'm thinking on this, if people check it, we could have the regular equatable for net address do all of them and then have some method which just compares the address itself. So you can know, hey, is this a remote or local address? Are these two things coming from the same machine as compared to, I want to know that it's the same port and everything else, right?
Right.
Which is where this came from initially is we found in testing that on Linux that whether you want to turn Nagle on or off depends on whether or not you're talking to a remote or local machine.
Oh, indeed, yes.
Because if the Nagle settings, you want them to be basically the exact opposite of each other, depending on whether it's a local or remote that you're talking to.
Yep. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. So yeah, I think rename this eek to some other useful name. Watch me not try to name something.
Post eek.
Actually, that's not bad.
What's not bad?
Host-eek.
Host-eek.
Somebody spell that for me.
HOST_EQ.
Host-eek. I kept hearing post, and I'm like, I don't understand.
Ghost equal. A spooky method.
Ghost? What the? Yeah, and then do one that's whole darn thing for the actual eek, which is good. We should have an actual eek.
Yep. So yeah, I can go. I'll do those later today. Like,
awesome.
I'll close this one up and I'll open it up later on.
Right.
Cool. Dun 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 dun. Oh wait, let me take the needs discussion during sync off. Dun 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 dun. All right. Let's see. Looks like this one is at waiting for changes. Okay. Right. There's.
What's waiting for changes?
1542. You asked for some changes from that, Sylvan, and I don't, I'm not sure if, did you make those changes, Benoit? Should Sylvan be reviewing this again?
Yes, I think it's ready for review.
Oh, cool.
So I'm going to tag you on this, Sylvan, that you should review it, okay?
Yep.
Outside of this, all right?
Sounds good.
All right. Okay. Where is 1545 at? Is he still working on this? Yes, it looks like he's still working on this. 1545. Yep. Okay. All right then. Ooh, here's a fun one. 1556. Delay multi-producer, multi-consumer queue node freeing until the next pop by the same thread. And oh boy, let's talk about fences and ABA, shall we?
Let's talk about fences and ABA.
I love the American Basketball Association.
That's pretty good basketball. So the real question is, what do we want to talk about?
Well, how about we try to finish off the discussion between you and Benoit of what needs to happen here for this.
It looks like Benoit said that he's ready to gonna update the PR to get the ABA problem fixed.
Oh, okay.
That's where I thought we were.
Oh, well, that's because I didn't check to see that he had said something 13 minutes ago. Okay, then. All right. So.
So, jumping back to 1542.
Uh huh.
It's good.
Which one's 1542?
Load program symbols dynamically.
Yes. Okay. All right. So we're. Okay, let's. Boom, merging.
Awesome.
Done. All right. So, what else do we have here then? Okay, 1560, that has a needs discussion during sync. Does it still need? Let's see. Not sure why I put stuff on it. Did you ask for like some input on this, Joe? Is that why I slapped that on?
I don't know why you slapped it on.
We can
talk about it just to make sure it doesn't sound stupid. Basically, the gist of the refactoring. The goal was to avoid hitting. There are cases where we're doing a subtype check. For example, we want to say, is this arrow A val a subtype of this arrow B val, or something like that?
Yeah.
We end up to handle the this arrow, we end up doing a bunch of AST dupe. Calls to create like a viewpoint adapted version of the type. When we could first do a check to see, hey, if I ignore capabilities altogether and just say is A a subtype of B first, ignoring capabilities, then could save some of those allocations. That was the goal.
This looks like not only is this pure win, but I think we could look at using this to fix the bind cap problem.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
And I know why I slapped the thing on it now. To make sure that we all paid attention to it so we could get it merged.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, this is great.
All right, merge it.
Yes, please.
Yeah. Yeah, this came up because I'm I went back to working on a little bit of the Pony compiler and Pony stuff, and
that makes me so happy.
When the program starts to get big, you start to really notice where some of the slowdowns are in the compiler. Yeah,
totally.
All right, all of Dippin's ones. Do we want to talk about them before they go through CI, or shall we?
The benchmark one, now that it doesn't need CMake, is great, basically.
Okay. All right. So I'm going to put a note that this is good to merge as soon as it passes CI. Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. Sounds good. So, yes, for anybody who is listening, that's 1565. So how about 1566? You already approved it, Silva?
1566 is that's great. I already went through it.
All right. Okay, this can be merged as soon as CI passes. Comment.
I don't remember if it's necessary or not, but like since they both use the benchmark commit, they might, the second one that gets merged might need to be rebased before merging. I don't know.
I suspect what we'll want to do is
we can close the first one and just merge this one. It has both of them.
I would prefer to merge them as separate merges, if that's okay, and just rebase these two once they're in.
Okay.
Or maybe squash on merge is enough to do that.
It might do.
That might be enough.
I don't know if he changed.
I don't think so.
CMake.
It'll tell us if there's a conflict.
Yeah, that's
true. Just try to squash it. Otherwise, ask for a rebate.
Yeah, good call.
He's already done a lot of.
Ton of work, and the last thing I want to do is give him anything else to do when he's done all this awesome work.
I can't. He did get paid for all of it.
Hey, yay! It does mean there's now Python in our repo, which makes me feel dirty.
Oh, I didn't notice. There was already some Python for the building on Windows stuff.
Yeah, yeah, that's true.
Yeah. Okay. 1565. Sorry, 1568.
Yes. I must admit, I have not gone through this one because I couldn't figure out where the changes were because GitHub kind of barfed on me.
Oh, wow. Yes. It's having a slightly hard time showing me all the diffs. That's fun. I need a supercomputer.
It should be easier to view the diff after after the other PRs merged, I think.
Okay.
So maybe we should just hold off.
Yeah, we can hold off on this one until we get the other stuff there. So on to issues then. Look at these fun ones. Okay, let's start with I don't know why this one still has that label. So really quickly, Sylvan?
Yeah.
Don't make me send you a third email asking for the Artifactory login stuff.
Uh-oh. Okay. That sounds like I'm in trouble. I better go look at my email.
Yes. Yes. As some people may be aware, previously we were uploading all of our nightly things to Bintray, which is and basically abusing the Bintray account. It's supposed to be for releases only. They were very polite at JFrog about that.
I would just like to reiterate at this time our thanks to the nice people at JFrog.
Yes, and they wonderfully have agreed to give us a free Artifactory. account, which we have. Sylvan set it up and everything. So we have two issues open. One is 1555, which I think is generally actually the more pressing one, is somebody needs to script the API to go through and delete all the old nightlies so that they get their disk breaks back. And that's ready for work and straightforward using the HTTP API. And then the other one is to switch our build process over to where we had previously turned off the uploading of snapshots to Bintray over to using Artifactory. And I wanted to have a quick discussion about that. I created the issues for it. It's 1554. My question would be, is we have enough people here to actually discuss this, is I'm not aware of anybody using those nightlies or us actually getting any value out of them right now.
They were really important before the Windows build was fixed, and now not so important.
So I put priority high on this. We could drop this down to a much lower priority if we don't think it's all that important.
Thoughts, anybody?
It's probably not that important. It's just important that we stop abusing terms of service of Bintray, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah. Which we're at least we need to clear this stuff out, but we're not adding to the problem at this point.
I'd be happy to take care of deleting the old stuff off of Bintray if I can get those credentials.
Yeah. Sylvan, can you get him the credential? I think
Bintray stuff?
Yeah.
Or maybe I already have them. I don't think I've ever
asked. Yeah, I think you probably have them.
Okay.
When I put the note there, I just assumed it would be, I was operating the assumption that maybe somebody else would come along. What? Okay, cool.
I don't seem to have Bintray credentials.
Yes, you do, because you have a login. And you're also the owner of the account.
Oh.
So you certainly have it's like you are a user who has an account, who has access to a thing, and then you can create accounts for other people.
Oh, I see. It's because it's Bintray is signed in with GitHub, that's why.
Yeah, and then you can create accounts for other people.
Oh, so maybe I can sign in with GitHub, okay.
Yes. Yes, and then you should have an account for that. I always sign it. Okay, so we have that. If you run into trouble, Joe, let me know, and I have enough access to be able to create accounts. I created Theo's for him, so I know I can do it. All right,
I was able to get into the account, but I don't seem to have access to the PonyC repo, so I need to be added to that.
Okay.
MC.
Can you drop a quick note to me on that, and I'll do it after the sync? But.
Okay.
I am forgetful enough today that if there's not something in my email to remind me, I'm going to forget.
Sure, I'll just put it in the ticket.
Which would we rather talk about first? Foreign objects not being properly accounted for in GC, or the undeclared FFI call type signatures are not validated? Sylvan, pick one.
It doesn't matter. I'm trying to get credentials at the moment. And send them to you before I'm in more trouble than I'm already.
All right.
Either one is fine.
Let's do 1550 because I like that one. The foreign objects are not properly accounted for in GC. So, yeah, I was talking to Sylvan about this before the sync. We get it on here. If you follow through on this, what happens is that there's a heuristic for how much memory is being used by how much memory is probably being held by objects which are in some other actor's heap, which they've sent to us, so that we can use that to trigger our own GC. Because if you imagine that if we have an actor that's only receiving like objects from remote ones, from other actors, and we didn't do this, it would never GC, and therefore all those other actors would have to hold on to those objects forever, right? Obviously, bad thing. So we do a heuristic in order to do that. The problem is that we do this at the time that that we receive the object. We add this amount to the value of what our heap used is.
Right.
which is great and wonderful, except that after the first time we do a GC, what we do is we reset the heap used to zero with the idea then at the end of, well, when we do start GC, we set it to zero. And then when we're done GCing, we reset the amount that we have used. But the problem is that we're only actually figuring out how much we're using for our local heap, and we never do that heuristic again to get a heuristic for how much we're holding in foreign references, which means that we don't GC as often as we should to potentially free
stuff. It's the other way around. We GC more often than we should.
How is it we GC more often?
Because let's say we don't ever allocate our own memory, right?
Uh-huh.
And we receive 16 kilobytes of externals, of remote memory,
uh-huh.
and we hold on to all of it.
Uh-huh.
But our heap looks like, after we GC, that we're using zero memory.
Yes.
Then we receive another 16 kilobytes of memory. Now we're really holding 32, all right? But we're GC, and we GC, and it looks like we're holding zero, and we're really holding 32. These have been done at the right time. Now we receive another 16 kilobytes. It looks like we were holding zero, and now we hit 16, and we GC again, which is wrong because we've GC'd at 48 kilobytes when our next GC should have been at 64 kilobytes.
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying on that particular one. Yes.
Yeah.
And it'll also cause to GC more often on the other actor.
Yeah.
Much more often. So yes, we need to figure out. Do you have any thoughts, Sylvan? So I went through this and it looks like this never worked correctly.
Yeah.
Do you have thoughts on how we would go about?
My favorite thought was offered by Tobias Rikstad, who's at the University of Uppsala, who said, "Well, it's not a bug. It's just that it's a slightly different heuristic than we thought we had." Excellent. But what we really need to do is in mark remote object.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
We need to make the same call essentially to pony hint int heap used as we do in receive remote object.
Right. Okay. So that would make sense. So in mark.
And then the other side of that is in mark remote actor.
Okay, wait, let me actually get this in, okay? In yep. mark remote object, so I want to make sure. In mark remote object, we need to do the same call for a heuristic hint that we use in, that's receive remote object, right?
Yeah.
Receive remote object.
And then in mark remote actor, we want to do the same pony int heap used call that we do for receive remote actor. Okay. Now, one of the differences is in both of these cases.
Same call that we do in what?
Receive remote actor.
Yes, okay.
The difference between them is in receive remote actor and mark remote actor. In receive remote actor and receive remote object. We're only doing the pony int heap used call if object RC was zero.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in mark, we're always going to do it as long as we've passed the GC mark test.
What is the, I'm not looking at the code right now. So what is the GC mark test?
Oh, it's just if aref mark equals GC mark return. In other words, we've already marked this actor, or similarly in mark remote object. Okay.
So where's the remote actor? So in remote actor, where's the mark remote object? Right. So if we get past the object, if it's not object equals GC mark, right?
Yeah.
Basically, we can do it any time after we do implicitly mark the object owner. Right. Okay. Uh,
ideally, it would be nice if Sendence did this change and saw the result on their code base before inflicting it on everyone else.
You mean like a lot of things, and then sometimes we inflict them on other people, and then it turns out we find things after the fact? Yes, we can do that.
Yeah, that'd be it. Yeah. Thank you. Just a question of a large enough code base with enough tests, performance tests.
Yes. Okay. All right. And I will assign this to Sean or Dippin. And bug ready for work. Needs discussion during sync. Difficulty easy. Priority high. Okay. Awesome. That's looking good. So how about undeclared FFI call type signatures are not validated. That is 1552.
Yeah, so let me go ahead and there is this issue kind of spiraled out into a series of, I guess, larger questions about FFI and how it should be treated. So I'm just kind of going to give a little bit of honing in on the specific things that really need discussion here.
Cool.
So the original issue reported was that, calling the same function two times in the same program with the different return value type, and the example was I64 and I32, creates besides being just like kind of wrong, it creates a compiler assertion error when that happens.
Actually, no, it doesn't. What it does is it picks one at random.
Well,
the debug build asserts.
Okay, the debug build asserts. Yes. Yes. Okay.
Sorry. Yeah.
Sorry. Yeah. Yeah. So we spent 3 days figuring out why the hell we got different results from different builds.
Yeah. Well, in discussing whether we want to turn on assertions in the release compiler, right, is another ticket. But yeah, so it creates a compiler assertion there. So obviously that's something that is broken, and I kind of agree that, I agreed right off the bat that that's something that when we detect that's going to happen, we should give a useful compiler error instead of letting the assert happen in LLVM. So, but then it kind of, the issue got broader into, should we allow any conflicting FFI calls to happen, whether declared or undeclared? In the case of undeclared, we're treating them all as variadic when it comes to the arguments, and so we could maybe, if it's undeclared, we can easily tell that, well, the return value should never differ, but the arguments can, because it could be variadic, or maybe we need to have some way of marking it as variadic. And then it kind of got out into a larger discussion, well, how should we detect that they are incompatible? Because I was sort of putting forward the claim that incompatible by pony type system is too strict for FFI, especially because you could have two packages that wrap the same C library that, yeah, create a struct type for an argument of return value, and in the pony type system, those are always going to be distinct types, no matter what we do, unless we were going to try to get into comparing them structurally. But even then, they'd have different methods, so they need to be distinct types. So the question is, how compatible do they need to be to make sense? And I was sort of putting forth the claim that they should be compatible by like memory layout in the call, whereas basically any, for example, any struct pointer, we treat it like void star, and we let the user shoot themselves in the foot if they need to. But that's kind of the only way that I see it happening for that. But we could, for example, the I64 versus I32. That's something that we very well could determine. It's not possible that both of these are correct.
Yeah, I agree completely. I think it's actually the right thing to look at is the underlying LLVM types that we generate, because that'll give us the memory layout without any work. And if those are the same, we're good. And if they're not, we're bad. And okay.
Basically, in the code gen phase, we'd have a check that goes through and looks for occurrences of a given FFI call globally. Make sure that all the occurrences need to have the same return value memory layout. But what about the arguments when it comes to like variadic stuff? Print out.
I think there's two things that happen here. Mm-hmm. So in gencall.c, there's declare FFI var arg and declare FFI.
Right. But I think undeclared FFI calls where we're not declaring a signature, I think they're variadic by default, as Dipin found.
Right. So there's an interesting thing we can do here, which is when we go through and call declare FFI var arg declare FFI, we end up building up a signature for the method. And so one of the things that happens here, so if you check out declare FFI, it's called from genFFI when we couldn't get the named function, right? We would said, hey, get the named function. And it says, well, there isn't one. And we say, okay, is there a declaration? If so, declare FFI. Otherwise, is it an LLVM internal call, LLVM dot, in which case declare FFI. Otherwise, make it var arg. And what we can do here is validate against the signature that comes back there. So declare FFI var arg is actually giving us a variadic function. And we can actually ask LLVM, hey, is that a variadic function? And it'll let us know.
And this is something that happens, I guess. When you say get named function, you're talking about like from the linker?
So actually, yeah, this is like line 981 from gencall.c, and it's LLVM get named function. And what that does is it looks up in the LLVM module a function declaration by name at the LLVM level.
Right, which would correlate to a pony source, the use statement for FFI, right?
Essentially, well, I mean, this might be coming from a use, or it might just be coming from an FFI call that wasn't pre-declared. So one of them will get generated first, and then the others, we go through and we build, and we just assume it's going to work. And what we really need to do is, in fact, we even check on line 1010, bool var arg, where on the F type is set to LLVM is function var arg. So and we go through and we actually cast parameters to the param type. So what we can do is we can, on lines 1024 and 1025, we can check for whether a given FFI arg cast is valid or not. Is it the right memory layout? And if not, we can raise an error. And also, we can pick up the return type that's coming that we can get out of F type. I don't know if we're pulling it at the moment. We're not pulling it at the moment, but we can pull that return type check that against the expected pony return type right there. Did any of that make sense?
Right. I'm just wondering, okay, so for a function which is called without being declared with a use statement, how does LLVM is function var arg know if it is a var arg or not? Like, is it just always a var arg?
It just is.
Okay. So it always is if undeclared.
Yeah.
Okay.
The CABI is actually rather flexible about that. as it doesn't actually set up any difference between vargs and not vargs. You just push stuff on the stack or through the ABI, and on the other side, it protects registers or pops stack as it thinks you must have done in order to call it. So under the hood, everything's varg anyway.
Right. Okay. So then basically the only change we need to do then is that cast FFI arg, we want to raise compiler error if we can't do that cast.
That, and we want to make sure that the return type, so on line 1008, you'll see that we're getting an F type.
Uh-huh.
We should pull the return type and make sure that it matches what Pony is expecting to return here.
Okay.
By memory layout, of course.
Yeah.
In fact, we don't even really have to, we can pull that out of result as is set on lines 1042 and 1044. We can build the call, invoke the function, and then we'll get a result. It'll have a type. We can go through and grab its type, and we can do it that way as well. Either way.
Okay. And I'm just trying to get oriented here. Where did you say the... okay, yeah, it's the result is what we're calling the return value. Because we can't use the word return in C code. Okay, I get it. I was looking for the words like ret or return value. Okay, yeah. So, yeah. All right. Yeah,
and so cast FFI arg should do some validation on that cast and not... Basically, right now, it doesn't do much validation.
Yeah.
And by not much, I mean none.
Okay. And so the end result of all this would be that for undeclared FFI calls, we don't do any kind of validation that the arguments in different calls match because they could be variadic.
Right.
But on declared FFI calls, we would be doing validation on both the arguments and the return value, and we would also want to do a validation that declarations across packages result in the same underlying FFI named function declaration.
Right. If we do this, we'll get it across package automatically.
Yeah, because we're already past the point where packages matter at this point.
Yeah. And your whole thing about it's based on memory layout, I agree completely, in case that wasn't clear.
Yeah, okay. That sounds great. Thanks for clarifying everything. And that sounds like it's a pretty easy fix compared to what it could have
actually
been.
Actually, yeah. Given that it's a damn complicated subject, fixing it is actually, I think, going to be pretty straightforward.
Thanks, LLVM, for making it
easy. Thank you, LLVM, for so many things.
Okay, I think that rounds out the discussion there. I will record a comment talking about the summary.
Excellent. Can we have a quick talk about 1567? Is that all right?
Wait, sorry. Oh, sorry. I was muted and I was wondering why nobody ever said... Yeah, okay. Joe, so what's the final thing I didn't really follow along with? Are we turning on those asserts for the release compiler as well in general, or?
That's a separate ticket to talk about it. I think we didn't really discuss that.
Okay, all right. So which one did you want to talk about, Sylvan?
Number 1567.
1567. Oh, okay. All right. The one where everybody says you're wrong.
Yeah.
Yes.
And everyone else is right, is basically what my comment is.
Okay.
Is that, yeah, okay, compiler writers and runtime writers disease, obviously these are separate things. But yeah, clearly at a language level, people would really expect this to work.
Yes.
The only thing I want to add to that is is a super type of a boxed type, which is Benoit's comment checking if something could be a super type of a box type. That's going to be tricky, I think. Because I don't think that will is actually the whole thing. Because we could compare a tuple. We could do is with a tuple. And now we get into the horror of tuples without class, just without type descriptors. So I think as a way to start doing it, that may well be good, and it will save the runtime stuff that I was worried about. It does mean dynamic checks when you have two things that could be super types of a boxed type, and that's mildly annoying but not terrible. It basically means things like stringable. If you have two stringables and you ask if A is B, it's going to look at their dynamic type before it lets you know. That's not terrifying. It means it's not as fast as a straight pointer compare, but it's pretty good. And right, that's basically it. Tuples really need type descriptors.
So that would effectively mean that basically all tuples would become boxed?
No, not exactly.
Okay, I won't make you explain it better than that.
No, it's worth talking about. The idea is to turn tuples into full object types, so they'll all be pointer width larger. However, they will keep value rather than reference semantics. So that essentially, if you have a tuple, it's like having an embedded object everywhere because it has value semantics. So that they behave exactly like they do now in terms of performance, so that you can do things like return a tuple and you're not worried about the fact that, oh, wait, am I allocating an object to return because that would stink? No, you're not. It's fine. We can return it on the stack as you would expect. But it'll gain a field, essentially. All tuples will take a bit more space.
Okay, that makes sense. Thanks.
Yeah. We could make tuples have reference instead of value semantics. But if that were the case, it would make returning multiple values is the main thing that would be kind of a pain in the ass. And if we were to do that, we would definitely want the ability to have some array type that accepts only in some way shallowly clonable types, or introduce a first class construct for the difference between reference and value semantics that we could apply to any type. Is anyone familiar with the difference between a class and a struct in C#, for example? Basically, a struct has values. Yeah, exactly. So a struct has value semantics, where if you say A, assign B to A with a class, it just makes A the same pointer as B. But if you do it with a struct, it's a different object, but you copy all the fields. And that has implications on how they store stuff, because you can do things like return a struct and it doesn't have to allocate something, which is similar to how a tuple works. So if anyone has any thoughts on a nice syntax where we wouldn't distinguish at the type level, but rather at the reference level between reference and value semantics, I think that might be interesting to explore.
Yeah, I see what you're saying. That would be interesting. I wonder if maybe we should open an RFC.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a good idea.
More of just a brainstorming thing on this one.
Yeah. It would give you the ability to have things like an array where it's not an array of pointers to objects, but an array of the objects themselves. which can sometimes be a performance win. And sometimes it's a massive performance loss when people thought it would be a win, but, you know, life's tough.
Okay, but it sounds like the short-term solution would be to add another element to tuples, which is the type descriptor. It's invisible right at the language level.
Exactly, and that will have two other big implications. The first is it will massively simplify the code generation for pattern matching. It will simplify code generation for tracing. And it will mean that some things that the compiler thinks are subtypes right now should no longer be subtypes, which means we can simplify the subtyping code. And it gets rid of the union of tuples being equivalent to the tuple of unions problem, because they will no longer be equivalent.
I'm not familiar with that one, but I'm also not. I just tried to work through it in my brain, and yeah. I'm not. My brain's not here enough anymore.
Okay, we can talk about that next week.
It's like, wait, nope, not functioning at that level right now.
It's a problem that has been a constant source of mild consternation. Andy McNeil particularly had several places where he said, look, there is no canonical representation, and this is basically a combinatorial attack on the type system. And he was totally right, and it turns out the right solution wasn't to come up with a canonical representation, but to make tuples have type descriptors and be more concrete.
So this issue here, do we want to make any changes to the labels that are on it right now?
For 1552?
1567.
Oops.
Oh,
right. We switched. No, I don't think so.
Bug needs investigation.
Do we want to talk about as it applies not just to tuples but to numeric primitives?
For this one, I think Benoit's approach of checking for supertypes of box types works really well for machine word ones.
Okay, great. I just wanted to make sure that was covered.
Yeah.
Just want to make sure everything that was recorded in the issue that we needed to record there.
Yeah, yeah.
But you should have an invite email to Bintray, Joe. Let me know when you accept it, and I'll elevate your permissions.
Okay.
Alrighty. We're getting near the end here. I think we've made it through a good number. Anybody have anything they want to bring up before we call it a sync?
I think I had something. Okay, go ahead, Benoit.
Okay, thanks. I have a question on genmatch.c in the check tuple function. There is a comment on line 113 that says that if we load the descriptor from an object and that it's null, we should load the object itself. So I was wondering when can it happen? Because I'm doing some changes in that area, and I'm wondering what's.
I think this is very impressive that you've gone straight to that code. That is the exact function that will be massively simplified once tuples have type descriptors. Okay, so. A null descriptor goes into a so right. the thing that we're loading is the a field descriptor, right? So we're getting the field info out of the descriptor for the tuple. Then we get the field pointer off of the pointer using the field info, because we're looking for field I, right? Then we get the field descriptor as well. So it's a null descriptor if it's an object type. If it's a machine word type, it has the descriptor for the machine word type.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, if it's a machine word or a tuple type, it's a null descriptor. So that's why we load the object, is because we have one. We have one with a type descriptor. So fantastic. We can go from there. Otherwise, we cheat and use the descriptor that we pulled out of the field info and continue with that.
Oh, okay.
Also, yeah. Also, I'm really, really sorry. This code is hard, and it should have been a clue when I was first writing it that tuples needed type descriptors.
Anything else?
I thought I had something, but I guess I think we'll...
Okay. You have full permissions on Bintray now, Joe? All right. And at admin level, so if somebody else needs it in the future, you can hand it out too.
Oh, actually, I think I did have... I have one more thing to follow up on. It should be quick. It was an issue. I'm looking for the issue ticket here. One where I asked Sylvan something and he answered, and then I asked him something else. Something about compiler performance.
Was it about AST? T being double the size it used to be?
No, okay. Issue 1562. It's about the flattened pass.
Oh, right, yeah.
Right, and you said in your comment, eliminate both flattening and type alias substitution. And I'm just trying to get clarification. Do we want to eliminate the entire flattened pass? Do we want to just eliminate union flattening, or just eliminate union and intersection flattening?
Right.
And I also, my follow-up kind of comment was, I don't understand why we want to eliminate union flattening and why that's desirable if we're going to just get rid of the type alias substitution. It seems like that would be enough.
It may well be enough. The thing is for both flattening unions and flattening intersections, if we did a better job printing them out, it might not actually be a performance problem at all to leave them structured in an unflattened way. At which point we could do that. We can't get rid of the pass as a whole, because we need flattened type param ref, and we need flattened sendable params.
Right. Okay.
And flatten provided type is
okay. So we basically would just want to consider getting rid of union and intersection flattening, but that's kind of but it seems like getting rid of the type alias substitution would be a sort of a separate in a good place to start. Like, not, they don't be entangled at all. They can be separate initiatives and just start with getting rid of type alias substitution, see where we are.
Totally.
And then think about eliminating union and intersection flattening.
Exactly.
Okay. And then my only concern was that it seems like some pieces of code that are working with unions and intersections might benefit from having them be flat in terms of just complexity and readability. But
that's very
I haven't
true.
Actually looked at that yet. So
yeah, that's very true.
Okay. Well, that clarifies everything I need to know.
Something I just realized, I don't know this if this is true or not, but it might be possible to change the way the parser pulls in union types and intersection types such that it's flattened at the parser level
instead of although pairs. I would say that the flattened pass isn't just flattening it structurally, it's also getting rid of, like, you know, if you said A or B,
right,
just make A or B.
Yeah. That's very true.
So the parser would not be enough if we still care about, and maybe all we care about, okay, so just one question about that. If we, do you think everything would go haywire if we only made the change of just flattening the union structurally and ignoring subtype relationships between union members?
For unions, that'd be fine. For intersections, that's not fine, because an intersection type that has locally incompatible reference capabilities, if you let that through, introduces reference capability violations into the compiler.
Okay, that's a pretty easy change that could be made today. Is just to, for unions only, flatten them structurally, ignore subtype relationships, and if somebody, you know, I think it's kind of probably going to be kind of rare that somebody makes a union like that, because it's not that useful.
They show up
subtype checks later. Is that what happens?
Yeah, it makes more subtype checks later, and they show up accidentally. Like, you have something that doesn't seem like it is, but actually it is. Particularly when you get to things that are generated from type parameters with constraints, or once you have a reified type parameter, and then you have union types you didn't expect, and that kind of stuff. It seems like maybe the right thing to do is just go straight for the gold and get rid of type alias substitution and see where that takes us. I think you're right. I think your first approach was probably the best.
Okay. I mean, I just think that, okay. Because even then we'll still be doing a lot of flattening, but not nearly as much. Okay. But just to clarify, you don't think it affects correctness?
I don't think so.
To not fold duplicate or, you know, overlapping union types together.
Right. It would for intersection, but not for union.
Right. Okay. I'll record that later, because I think that's important, and it might be something that I want to explore after seeing where type alias substitution gets us, but that's helpful to know.
Awesome.
And I look forward to implementing some of those performance improvements. Thank you for the
Sean just wants the recursive type aliases.
Oh, dear God. More than just Sean wants the recursive type aliases.
Yes.
Yeah, I want those too.
See? Not just Sean. True. Not just Sean.
I wanted them when I was working on the message pack parser, but then I just stopped working on the message pack parser.
It's one way to fix the problem with the compiler.
Whee! All right, so is that a
wrap?
That's a wrap?
That's it. Thank you.
Awesome. Okay. See you all next time.
Great. Bye, everybody. Thanks again.
Bye-bye.